Wherever there are damsels in distress and wrongs to be righted, especially with a ludicrous show of extreme wealth, there you will find the Clamp School Detectives.
We're Lucy and Robin, and we'll be your guides through Clamp's Wonderland.
Ludicrous.
Ludicrous.
Ludicrous shows of extreme wealth.
Ludicrous. Obscene.
So we're doing our little, like, context and history and then discussion of the first volume of Clamp Campus Detectives. Mm-hmm. I am so sorry because I cannot not say Clamp Campus Detectives. It's definitely Clamp School Detectives.
Okay, same. Why?
The anime.
That's what it translates
yeah,
as?
Yeah.
Okay.
For whatever reason, and I can say that both of us definitely saw the anime before this was ever translated.
Mm-hmm. Back when we thought it would never be translated because it's so obscure as Clamp works go.
Yeah, yeah. We had no idea. We've mentioned multiple times. Like, there was just this era where Cardcaptor Sakura
X.
Right. And X and Magic Knight Rares were so big in the US, but all of their older stuff was just barely alluded to, and and so many things were impossible to get in the US. Like, just the translation efforts, like, no publishers were willing to touch this stuff. Like, there just nobody knew that there was demand for it, and it was just this huge, huge sea change from this being incredibly niche to being really, really close to mainstream here.
Yeah, there were a few things of that era that, like, it was just commonly assumed that we would never get it in, like, a legal or official way, and, like, most of the early Clamp stuff was part of it. I mean, we still haven't gotten quite everything, but we've gotten pretty much everything that got a major release in Japan, you know, beyond just, like, magazine and shoten and stuff.
Yeah. Speaking of which, what did this run in?
This ran in two magazines, actually. It ran in Weekly Asuka, I think Weekly, and Mystery DX. It started in Asuka in January of 92, and then ran in Mystery DX starting in September of 92. And it's interesting to see something that ran in two magazines, because I feel like that doesn't happen very often.
Yeah, especially concurrently.
Yeah, yeah. Sometimes one will, like, it'll start in one, and then it'll get switched to another or whatever. And it should be noted, Mystery DX is, it looks like an imprint of Asuka, so it wasn't a completely different publisher or anything like that. And it looks like both are aimed at shoujo, but more like teen girls, like a little bit older than I had expected for this.
Yeah, like it's not like a super, super elementary school aged audience necessarily. Although, I mean, when we talk about like the audience for any comic magazine, we're like, this is like industry talk of like what markets are. Like, this is who they think they're aiming it at, and that mostly has to do with who's advertising in them. Mm. Not actually some sort of like, they don't necessarily have a psychologist telling you exactly how old someone needs to be to handle this material. This is really mostly handled by marketing people, which is a thing to think about. Especially because Monthly Asuka is also the magazine that ran a bunch of Clamp work, especially like, I think this was the first thing that they ran for them, but they ran work for them for years and years and years, very notably X.
Yeah, and if you'd asked me if X and Clamp Campus Detectives ran in the same magazine, I would have, like, laughed, because they seem like they're a wildly different audience, but, I mean, we read both of them.
Yeah, we sure did. And it definitely colors a little bit of the discussion we're going to have about why are these characters the way they are?
Mm-hmm.
Like, we are going to actually have to say a few things about that instead of just saying, oh, it's just kid stuff for kids. We're like, it's a little weirder than that.
Yeah. All right, so why don't we give a basic of what this thing even is, and then we can kind of talk about, like, where it came from and, you know, what else is in it, and just in case, because I feel like it's one of the more obscure Clamp things. Like, it's not
like
as well-known.
At this point, it is.
Yeah, like, in current, like, anime fandom.
Yeah, I would say, like, 10 years ago, or maybe, oh my god, I'm so old, 15 years ago, that anime was something that got licensed and was out here way early, and so there were, especially for, like, female fans and people who were looking for stuff that wasn't violent, like, this is something you might have just run into and watched having no idea that it was connected to a huge, like, AU doujin verse. Like, you wouldn't necessarily know that.
Yeah, like, I remember watching the anime, and we're gonna watch and talk about the anime, so we'll get into it more in another episode, but I learned, like, a lot of Japanese from that anime, because it was one of the first things that I found that wasn't dubbed. And there may be a dubbed version of it, but for whatever reason, our little comic book store had it subtitled, so
yeah,
we got to see it that way.
Yeah, and there's a lot of interesting language stuff that comes up in this that, like, it's not interesting now, but it might have been interesting to us at the time because the characters use, like, varying levels of politeness because they're very respectful of each other, but also they're all a bunch of rich kids who are using, like, this very formal speech that, in order to make them look kind of, like, sophisticated and distanced from the audience, maybe, and definitely sophisticated and different and distanced from normal elementary school students who probably don't talk like that to their peers all the time.
Yeah, and it also gives you some subtext about the other characters they're interacting with. And I really appreciate in most of Tokyo Pop stuff, but especially in this one, there's a little, like, before the manga begins, there's this little section that's just kind of telling you about different honorifics and kind of how this works. And so I like that they retained that, because those are a thing that's so hard to translate into English. Like, we do have, you know, levels of formality in our language, but they're not quite as straightforward as in Japanese with honorifics and stuff.
It's definitely not comparable in a way that is easy to explain to somebody the age level that you would expect to be reading this.
Yeah.
Because in the U.S., this is published under an all-ages label. Like, that is definitely the audience. They're like, oh yeah, this is appropriate for basically anybody. And I think it is. Like, there is nothing objectionable in this. I mean, there are things I find questionable in terms of writing decisions, but there's nothing in it where you're just like, oh, you're gonna have to have a talk with your child about this.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, when I'm talking about, like, what's age-appropriate, I mostly just mean, do we need some more discussion in order to, like, give this issue, like, actual fair thrift? Like, or is this something that probably any kid has already thought about and had to deal with anyway?
Yeah. So, our story features the three student council members of the elementary school division.
And yes.
They are...
I mean, who could be more important?
I know. Very, you know, very high, powerful members of your school. which is part of kind of the fantasy of the show, is the strange level of power that these elementary school students have over...
Because they do seem to have a lot of power
at
the school.
Both, like, literal power and, like, social power.
Yes. Soft power and hard power.
Yes. So they are Nokoru Umonoyama, who's the chairman, and he's also, his family owns and runs the school, so he's, you know, very entrenched in the school.
And I need to stop you there, because we had this great discussion come up on Twitter, thank you very much, from our Twitter buddy, at 5pm, or TullyTree. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much!
Because I knew that Umonoyama can be transliterated as Mountain of Sweet Potatoes. I knew that, but I had just totally forgotten it when we just, like, our brains flew out of our heads when we were, it was Duke Leon. We were feeling really dumb. And so, yeah, like, this was, like, a punny joke on their own name, because Clamp likes to refer to Clamp as meaning a pile of potatoes, which I'm sure it does, but not in any way that an English speaker would recognize, right? But it's probably one of those things where, like, you have, like, bushels, like these, we have lots of terms.
Yeah,
that
I'm
mean,
sure it's one of those technical
collective nouns, that
like a murder
weird.
Of crows.
Yeah.
Doesn't come up as much in normal conversation, although that one kind of oddly does.
Well, we don't have normal conversations.
That's true.
But thank you so much for reminding us that Umonoyama is, I mean, a mountain of sweet potatoes, a pile of potatoes. It's a little code name, a little code word.
And the pun got even better, because we weren't sure the whole Umonoyama Shopping District Association. Shopping district is Shoten, which is also the name of their early, you know,
like
little
Dojin
self.
Magazine.
Yeah, which means, like, laughing matter, or kind of comedy.
Yeah, which is interesting, because that's so similar to how the word comics that we use in English means, like, comedy, means, like, a humorous thing, means or a stand-up comic, like, that is the same word that we use for, you know, sequential art with text.
Yeah.
So that was really fun. Like, I don't know, we're getting into some linguistics there that we will probably want to play around with later in another episode, because I love it, and I just, language,
Yeah, well, and there are so many puns that we're probably missing out on by reading only in translation.
Yes.
Like, some of the stuff we, like Rigveda and Tokyo Babylon, we do own in Japanese, so there are some things we can fact check, but, like, Duke Leon's not one that I own in Japanese, so I would have had no way of knowing that Shoten was where the pun was happening there, so that was delightful.
Yeah, I'm sure this is full of those, and I'm happy. we're happy to have people tell us things like that that we're missing. I would also, like, I think I'm gonna keep my eyes peeled for some of these volumes in Japanese.
Yeah, it would be nice.
My house doesn't have room for every single comic in the world, but I am a fool and might need this.
Yeah. All right. It's for research, Robin.
It's for research. It's fine. Okay, this is a long digression talking about poor Nokoru.
Yeah.
Not at all poor Nokoru, in fact. Super extra, super fabulous Nokoru.
Yes. Monoyama. So he is the chairman of the elementary school student council. He's a sixth grader. Then we have Suol.
12 entire years old, guys.
12 entire
so
years.
So mature and sophisticated.
Mm-hmm. So then we have Suol Takamura, who is the secretary. Yes. Going off of memory here, guys. Yes. Super fun. I even have notes. Not useful notes.
For people who are our age, he's the Kyoya to Nokoru's Tamaki.
He definitely, definitely is. And then, of course, we have our buddy Akira Ijuin, whose name I cannot say, who is the treasurer and who we know from Man of Many Faces and his delightful thieving.
I do love that the class treasurer is a super thief.
It's pretty delightful.
He's also a baby. Like, they're all babies. They are, like, wet fetuses. But he is a fourth grader, and is just a tiny, tiny child. And it's really... And that comes up in this a lot, because they actually think of him as being naive compared to them, which is very funny.
Yeah, it's very cute.
Yeah, like, he sort of doesn't always understand the conversations that they're having, and he sometimes, like, says something that is adorably innocent and naive. And you would think it would be annoying. It kind of is just great.
Yeah, it's just kind of charming, like...
Their interpersonal relationships are kind of adorable. They're not... This is not, like, deep character studies at all.
Yeah.
Like, Nokoru is so extra. He is so excited about every project he's ever... Like, he will do nothing halfway. He does everything as extreme as possible. He's very over the top. Poor Suol has to... I mean, he sort of tries to rein him in. He doesn't try very hard. He mostly just tries to make sure things are working and functional. But there's a lot of, like, head desking and forehead slapping as he has to deal with his extremely extra best friend.
Well, he's kind of the straight man of the group who's just trying to be, like, you know, logical and rational. And
grounded in any way, which the others are not grounded in any way.
And Nokoru's just like, throw money at it! And Akira's like, I made cookies!
Yes. And then Suol's like, actually, maybe we should think for 5 minutes about whether this is any sort of appropriate course of action. He is, of course, also from a ninja family, and he himself is a super martial artist who was so good at martial arts that he had to drop out of the school clubs because it was too boring when he was beating all the adults.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. They're all super babies, like, so much so.
Yes.
So they run the elementary school division student council, as we mentioned, but through the course of the first volume, Nokoru, decides that since they're so good at solving problems, they need to be their own little detective agency, and specifically to right wrongs done to women, basically.
Yeah, they refer to him as having sort of like a supernatural sense for when women are in trouble, and what we mean is, from like a mile away, he can tell that a old lady is crying at the Tokyo Tower.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
from their blimp.
Yeah, from their blimp. They definitely have a blimp, because why would they not have a blimp?
I mean, they had to survey Tokyo Tower from multiple angles to decide if they wanted to have their party there, Robin. It was very important.
What was it? What was it, the Christmas party for the school?
I think, it was going to be on the 23rd.
Yeah. I think we decided we were not going to do, like, a big, well, here's a reminder about what Clamp Campus is, but here would be an okay chance for us to say, this is the same big, rich, crazy school with 10,000 people who live and work there as Duke Leon and Man of Many Faces also spend a lot of time.
And this one we get to see a bit more of, well, only a bit more of the actual, like, classes, although it's mostly just students hanging out outside of class.
The main characters even mention that there are so many extracurriculars that they're not even sure they don't say this school should not be accredited. They don't say that. I'm saying that. But they do mention that it seems like they're always just doing extracurriculars. And of course you're like, yeah, well, these people are all being groomed to be, like, the rich upper crust, like, aristocrats of the world, so what are they ever gonna do other than throw parties?
Yeah, well, I think in the introduction it even says Clamp School is known as much for being a party school as it is for having really high academic and financial standards and everything. Ugh. Although it does say that it is open to anyone on merit, not based on wealth.
It sure does say that, and I totally believe them.
So, yes, once our trio have decided slash been dragged in by Nokoru to being detectives, they can, you know, go through a series of mysteries, quote-unquote, that they have to solve.
Yeah, I'm going to say that these mysteries are about as intricately plotted as the heists were in Niju Menso.
Or the, like, capers were in Dukleon, like.
Yeah. This is very much more about, like, them having so much fun with all of the ridiculousness. Like, this is a comedy, and it's very light, and it's very funny. Mm-hmm. It's not so much about, like, twisty-turvy mysteries. I do feel like it is worth pointing out that they knew that they were not writing very good mysteries, and I don't mean this as an insult in any way here, but we have a few interviews from them to just, you know, to refer to here, and one of them actually are these English volumes, which have some, I am very sorry because actual live human beings are going to get called out here, questionable graphic design decisions.
Oh dear.
but actually really, really thoughtful editorial decisions. Mm-hmm. And I'm really grateful to everybody who worked really hard on these, on this weird project. This mm-hmm. must have been a weird thing to have come across your desk. You're like, well, okay, we're gonna just do this. But in the back, they actually have a note from Clamp that was specifically for the English volumes and gives us a little bit of background. And they mentioned, like, oh yeah, no, we were really inspired by detective stories and really, really liked these. So that's great, but they absolutely admitted in the Clamp Nokiseki interview about Clamp School Detectives, they do mention that, like, Okawa's like, I couldn't come up with the twist. Like, I couldn't. It was not, that was difficult. I'm just like, yeah, it is hard. Writing mysteries is really difficult, especially if you don't want them to feel incredibly formulaic, mm-hmm. which, you know, there's people who make entire writing careers out of very formulaic mysteries that are all about the charisma of the detectives. Mm-hmm. And I would say this is doesn't even have the formulaic mystery. It's like all about the charisma of the detectives. And it's cute because I can kind of feel that I think they knew that. And it's not an insult to say these are not great mysteries. They were not supposed to be great mysteries. Mm-hmm.
That's not really the point, despite
no.
it being in the title, you know, detectives being in the title. You're right, it's really more about the characters and their interactions and just having fun.
Hijinks. Yeah. This is a hijinks comic. Mm-hmm. And I will say, like, Nokoru does solve most problems with money. and throwing ridiculous amounts of money at them.
Yeah.
And
ludicrous,
and
like we said.
Ludicrous. Like, ridiculous. Like nonsense. And I think we'll talk about why he can do that in a minute. Because, like, that's one of, we had this sort of, like, oh, what are we going to say about Clamp Campus Detectives? I'm like, oh, there are some things to say, though.
Yeah. There's a lot of cultural stuff going on here that we're not aware of when we were originally watching or reading this stuff as kids, but also that the average, like, American, even, like, anime fan may not be aware of. So there's a lot to dig into here. Surprising.
Yeah. And also, like, this is such an interesting era for them, because I think that, you know, like, hey, like, everything was starting to happen and starting to ramp up, and this was something that really was their, like, crossover fan fiction zone. Like, that's what Clamp Campus was, and here's, like, the last of the three things that they set in that school, like, in that setting with these characters, and it comes back up later. And some of the ideas in this come back up later. I am not stargazing. I'm just saying that they do. But this is sort of like, this is the end of that era of them focusing on all of their, like, projects that they had been working on when they were still in the amateur zone. Like, everything after this is the stuff that is there, like, oh, we were invited to pitch and we came up with something for this project. I just said that, but I know that there's some quibbles about that.
Yeah, I'm not sure how we'll get to them, because I think the other things that come out around 93 are still kind of in that initial, like, pre them being well-known phase where they were.
But none of those have to do with, like, the Clamp school stuff.
That's true. Yeah. We're kind of like, this is the last of the Clamp things that has at least survived, and that is you know, prominent in their later stuff, too.
Actually, maybe this is a great time to talk about the elephant in the room. Because here, we know that Akira has his own manga that he was in, mm-hmm. right? And then we know that Nokoru also co-stars in Duke Leon.
Like, but, founded it or whatever. Yeah,
but poor Suo doesn't appear to have his own comic. Only yeah. that's not true, as we found out.
Yeah, it's interesting because this is one... I mean, there are various Clamp works that are kind of lost to history and certainly lost to America where we just never got them. They maybe never got full volumes even in Japan. And one of them is Hagunsei Senki, which is it's kind of to record of Hagunsei War. And this is the one that is Suo's and also I think Nagi's. His little girlfriend, who will come up later, is also from this. And this is based on... it's their modernization of this old Japanese epic from 1914. Well, released 1814.
We just skipped a century.
Yeah, I know.
It happens.
It's fine. It actually matters, though, because it means it was definitely in the public domain.
Yes.
Which, I mean, they were doing doujin stuff, so it's not... you know, wild to think that they would have done something that wasn't in the public domain. Also, I don't know what the public domain is in Japan. But anyway.
This is classic literature.
Classic literature that was very prominent in Japan and very, like, influential in a lot of things.
And you may have heard of it because it has had so many different interpretive anime adaptations. It's the Hakenden, of course.
Yeah.
Which itself is kind of, like, influenced by the Suikoden.
Yeah.
The water margin, which, man, Suikoden is the Japanese version of the Chinese title, and I don't know the Chinese title.
Yeah, I don't know. I know that my sources were translating as water margin.
Yeah, like, that's definitely... I remember the day... because I was a big fan of the Suikoden video games, which don't really have much to do with the Suikoden, but do have 108 characters as the 108 stars.
Yes.
Of Suikoden. Okay. But I remember at some point my dad, like, walked into the room and was like, oh yeah, I've been reading this Chinese novel from, you know, whatever century that was, you know, like the water margin. And I'm like, oh no, I know what this is, but from the stupidest possible angle. And that's what it's like to be a nerd.
Yes.
In a family of nerds. From so many different nerdy angles. Anyway, that's my embarrassing story about how I know what a super classic novel is.
Yeah.
As I play video games.
It's happened to me on multiple occasions.
I don't always admit to this. But this one I will super admit to because there's just no covering that up.
Yeah, well, because it's very classic literature in Japan, but it never came out here. And there is, I'll include a link below, there is someone who's translating it, it seems to be.
And by it we mean the Hakenden.
The original, yeah.
Yeah.
But it's not, unfortunately, not the Clamp version, which I would like to see as well, but translating into English and making it available online so that people can actually read this classic literature because it just never came to America.
It definitely does have a legend, which is a legend that predates the book, having to do with a lady getting impregnated by the super noble family dog and having 8 kids who are now bound together through generations of reincarnation and stuff like that.
Yeah, so, and Clamp's version is basically those characters reincarnated into the Clamp school in quote-unquote modern era, and...
yeah, which at this point is the late 80s, early 90s, yeah. And it's no longer the modern era, but it will contemporary for the time.
Yeah, and I mean, the big important part is that Suo was one of those dog boy samurai reincarnations, and...
I don't know which one, though.
I don't know which one, and it wouldn't mean anything to me if I did, so.
This is not a Hakenden no. podcast.
But yeah, so that's part of the reason that he's a magic ninja, is because... well, yeah. Magic kung fu master or whatever you want to classify him
as. I seem to remember that this never, ever comes up. Unlike Duke Leon getting kind of mentioned and 20 Masks, the fact that Akira is 20 Masks comes up a lot because, as we mentioned in 20 Masks and Duke Leon, apparently no one knows this. Like, apparently Nokoru, who is very savvy, still doesn't actually know that Akira is definitely 20 Masks, even though 20 Masks is a tiny child who looks exactly like Akira wearing a mask.
Yeah.
Like,
and they're conveniently never in the same place at the same time and all the usual, you know, superhero issues.
Yeah, just like somehow they just don't know, which is a really, really... I still think that's a really funny conceit. Yeah. Like, that's a great running joke. So at least as of volume number one, nobody knows.
Yeah.
But those, like, come up as jokes, but I think they mostly don't mention the Hakenden stuff or the
yeah Agunsei Senki.
And we don't know this for certain, but our research led us to think that one of the reasons why that doesn't get mentioned and usually isn't listed with their work, I mean, it certainly never made it to Tankobon form. Like, yeah, there was
but it was actually published. This is not something that was just from, like, their doujin days. This was actually getting published in a magazine. I'm not sure which magazine, but...
And right around the same time as Rigveda, too. But it didn't get very far. Like, it really didn't get very far. And the thing that we have sort of surmised is that that may be because some of the people whose brainchild this was are the other earlier members who left.
Yeah, it was definitely something that was when there were still 6 or 7 of them, and so it may just be that the people who this mattered to moved on to other projects, and it wasn't a thing they wanted to continue. And that's just speculation. Like, I did find a website that also speculated that, but I couldn't find any, like, real hard evidence on this.
Yeah, I mean, some of this stuff, there may be lots of information about it that is just really difficult to find because it was ephemera at the time, it was just in magazines. This also could be stuff that is kind of uncomfortable and not really super for public knowledge because, yeah, it's, as we've mentioned before, like, you can imagine there might be some hard feelings or just some, like, legal messiness around who owns a project when there are 7 people working on it.
Yeah, yeah.
The fact that the
headaches.
Yeah, the fact that the 4 of them can work on anything together, and we keep saying this.
Continue to, it's so amazing.
It really is. The kinds of contracts that I have to go through to make sure my partner is credited as my flatter for comics right now are, like, nuts because they really are uncomfortable. Like, every time you add a person to a project, it's somebody else who has to split royalties, but it's also somebody else who, like, they have to give credit to and who they have to have tax information for. Like, it's actually adding an awful lot, and just the royalty calculating part is such a big deal.
Yeah. The flatter is part of coloring, right?
Yes. Yeah, they do. My partner does the flat colors for my professional comics, and that is a super awesome thing for him to do.
It's just definitely a job I did not know existed before you were doing.
Yeah. Well, it's one of those things that it doesn't have as much of an official... They are often not credited. Mm. Colorists often subcontract to people who do the flat color work for color comics.
Oh.
Similarly to how in Clamp, especially in this era, Igarashi Sensei often just referred to herself as the person doing the screen tones, which is a huge amount of work, especially with the amount of screen tones they were using in this era. We could say a little bit about the artwork. It's certainly not Tokyo Babylon style artwork with the really, really stark, stylized layouts. It's definitely a comedy.
Yeah, right? It's definitely, like, I don't want to say messier in a bad way, but it's a little rougher. Like, you can tell that this was probably much faster to draw.
Yes.
Much quicker to get through and to lay out and everything than Tokyo Babylon, which is so just dynamic in its layouts and everything.
Yeah, because it's trying to get all these different kinds of emotions across, and this thing is really mostly funny. It has moments where you're supposed to be impressed, but it's mostly just funny and cute.
Yeah.
But yeah, like, for people who are doing some of those smaller jobs, they often wouldn't even be credited. But in comics right now, there's a lot of, like, hey, maybe we should actually make everybody aware how much human labor goes into everything that you see.
Yeah.
A lot of indie people do everything all by themselves, and it is exhausting and very difficult, and a lot of indie people have a lot of help that is not necessarily something that they are legally obligated to tell you they're getting, and maybe even it is in their best interest to not tell you how many people are working with them, but they're still there. It's a really important part of any creative industry, I think. So back to Clamp School Detectives, kind of fascinating that at this point, like, they managed to be working on this thing that at one point in time was, again, a shared AU that other people were in.
Yeah.
And for them to still want to work on it, like, that definitely tells you that there was something they saw in these characters.
Yeah.
And I love that. Like, it's such a... I think that we're skipping ahead to sort of what we should probably end the episode with. right? And maybe we should. Maybe we should put a pin in the talking about the intersection between being, like, a fan fiction writer and communal writing, collaborative writing with friends. Well, I think we'll come back to
that. We'll come back to that.
We've got more groundwork.
Yeah. So, I mean, the plots are pretty straightforward. Volume 1 has 4 little, I think they call them, I don't know what they call them, but episodes or whatever, chapters.
Files.
Files. Oh, because they're detectives. Of course it's Files. It's so cute. So they have, there are four of them in the first volume. They are called Forever on Earth, Sleuths, Lost in a Maze, and My Fair Lady, which in that Clamp No Kiseki interview, they make a point of pointing out how they are all movie titles, and they did that intentionally for all of the Files. And usually they'd write it first and then, you know, pick a title that worked with it, but that was kind of a fun way. They were kind of giving homage to being movie lovers and stuff, yeah, which is really cool. And yeah, they're pretty straightforward. In the first one, as we alluded to, they're flying around Tokyo Tower because they're scoping it out. Nokoru notices this elder lady crying, and they...
Another hot grandma.
Another hot grandma. There was a moment in which I was like, is that Tsubudu's grandma?
Yeah.
But no.
She's definitely not the same person.
No, she's definitely not the same. It was like a you know, 1 second thing where I was like, wait, but no.
I like a foxy grandma myself, so I'm just like, oh, yes, good.
Mm-hmm. And so they end up meeting up with her, and it comes out that she's upset because her husband, who died years ago, or disappeared in the war years ago, and no one's ever confirmed whether or not he was dead or alive. Their special place was replaced by Tokyo Tower at some point in the last century. It's one of the places she could go to be near him, which is very important at the moment because her brother-in-law is trying to push her out of the home that she's had, that she shared with her husband, and is like the last place that he would know to go to find her. And
so this almost could be a Tokyo Babylon story. Yeah. Like there's that moment where you're like, is she a ghost? And no, this takes a turn into stupid immediately when Nakoto solves this problem and creates new problems by just throwing money at it.
Yeah, throwing money. Like,
there
money.
Is no mystery. Yeah. There's no mystery. There is nothing here. He literally just buys the home because he has money to do this, buys the home to give to her, but then decides to take revenge on the brother-in-law, who is a real estate broker, by buying his office space and filling it with zoo animals and getting him in a contract that says that if they try to evict him, or like that if they renege on him being allowed to just have zoo animals roaming the building, that then he'll have to pay 5 times what he originally paid for it. So, I mean, there you go. That's a plot.
Yeah. And so, yeah, he made that old lady really happy. And then he also, like, you know, got the kind of douchey guy has come up and by just throwing money at it. Like, it was not really, like, clever necessarily. Although he did understand contract law, I guess, which, you know, is something.
Yeah, or Suo did. I think Suo had a lot to do with that. So, great mystery story. But they weren't officially detectives at that point,
yeah,
anyway.
True.
I think that this is around the time they decide that they are, like, maybe... No, it's the second story.
It's the end of the second story. So the second story is Sleuths, and the chair lady of the school hires them to find this list of faculty placement for the next year that she has lost. And it comes out that it's not, like, a physical list. It's, like, a tiny little disk drive thing. I don't even know how, like, it's a tiny micro disk.
Tiny disk drive. Disk drive is when you put a disk
in. Yeah, no, I know. It's wrong. It's
this is better than, it is a tiny floppy disk.
Yeah.
That is the size of a memory card of a micro SD card now.
Yeah.
And has the storage space of, I don't know, not even remotely the storage space. Like, this is one of those things where they're coming up with, like, a future technology that is pathetic compared to current technology. And that's what happens when you write sci-fi, guys.
Is that not a thing? I assumed that was a thing that actually existed.
They even tell you that this mini floppy is something that they made on campus.
Oh, yeah,
they did.
I just assumed that it must have also happened in the 90s.
It did not. It is a micro SD card now.
Well, anyway, it has been misplaced. Stolen. And Nokoru kind of goes all Sherlock Holmes on the scene of the crime and figures out that a bird has come to...
A bird did it.
A bird did it. It picked it up while it was eating blossoms off of the table.
Yeah, and I mean, the logic isn't great here. I love that a bird did it.
I love it so much.
I'm a big Ace Attorney fan, and I don't think a bird did it in that one trial, but definitely a parrot got put on trial,
They're
and I was like, put in the sand.
Cross-examine a parrot.
Yeah, and I really feel like birds are inherently funny, and I'm just glad that there are so many birds in Clamp Camp's Detectives. Anyway, that's when they're like, oh, we should do this full time.
Yeah, Nuclear's like, I liked this so much that we will be the Clamp School detectives.
Yeah, that like we take this locked room mystery that was a bird did it, and then we turn this into, and as I just said, full time, it is definitely not full time. They are very busy being in school, being super geniuses. Every girl in the school has a crush on them, including the ones that are extremely not age appropriate, because this is where we're rolling. And also, I don't know, all of these student council duties that feel like they maybe have more authority at the school than anyone should.
Than any child should, anyway.
Yeah. And of course they're going to have a detective agency, that's fine. And naturally, I think Suo feels about the way I feel about it, that this is maybe ridiculous, but Akira is just like, yeah, why would we not do this? It's so helpful. I can have another part-time job. I'm not a super thief or anything.
Yeah. So their third adventure ends up being, basically, they have to find a girl's pet peacock that has gone missing.
This peacock has the greatest face.
I love it so much.
I don't think this influenced how I draw birds. I think maybe Lucy can tweet not only the face of this peacock, but also how I draw birds. Because I have a bird that I draw that is like my main mascot and logo, that, and I'm just like, oh yeah, it's definitely not influenced by this, because I think I was sort of drawing birds like this before I read this, but I feel in my soul that this is what peacocks are.
This peacock is, it yeah. just has the, like, derpiest face.
Like, yeah, but it. Also, like, a very self-obsessed, it's great. They do solve this by just filling the school with lady peacocks.
Lady peacocks with, like, GPSs or whatever.
Yeah,
them,
yeah.
So that not GPSs, like,
yeah, some kind of,
yeah, locators, so yeah. that they can't be further lost. And so that they will react if a male peacock comes near them. They were very clear about that. There's like an alarm system somehow built in now to the lady peacocks that will alert them if a male peacock comes within like 10 meters or something.
So it works, and she's reunited with her peacock in like one of the best double page spreads I've ever seen.
It's so beautiful.
Yeah, because the peacock still has its supremely goofy cartoon face, but it's crying to be reunited with its owner. It's great. It's a great story. It's a very sophisticated mystery, and he definitely solves it with his money.
Yeah.
Again.
Yeah.
His, I mean, and also having gone to the library and done, like, 5 minutes of research about peacocks.
Yeah. Although I think Swole already had more research about it than he did, so yes. He was like, actually, that's a bet. Because he wanted to, like, just use bird seed or something, and Swole was like, no, they eat lizards. We will have to find lizards.
Like, you want to fill the school with lizards? Nakoto seems really not excited about filling the school with lizards. Yeah. I am very excited about filling any building with lizards, just in case you wanted lizards. To know, I'm pro filling lizards. Spaces with lizards. Like, please, lizards. Lots of lizards. I will also point out that Nakoto is very upset when he learns that male peacocks have harems of 4 or 5 females. He thinks that's very unfair to the lady peacocks, and I think that's adorable.
It was very, very sweet and very, like,
he was really into it, but it didn't stop him from doing his best for these peacocks.
And so then in the last story in volume 1, kind of does address the fact that Nokoru has just been, like, throwing money at every solution. And so in this one, it is Valentine's Day, and in Japan, the tradition is girls will give boys chocolate, either that they've bought or made to show their affection, and then a month later, on White Day, boys will reciprocate with a gift. Doesn't fully come up in the episode, but just for some context. So Valentine's Day has happened. They are all getting, like, truckfuls of chocolate.
Yeah, like, the entire first few pages are just gags about how much chocolate these boys are receiving from everybody.
Yeah, and it's quite a hardship, but they're very, you know, humble about it, I suppose.
Yeah, they're, like, not enthused. Although, I put it, like, Suo feels like it's a burden. Like, this is way too much of a burden for him. Akira is a little upset because he has a girlfriend and he doesn't actually want to, like, manipulate anybody's feelings.
Yeah.
Nokoto is like, I will eat every chocolate because girls put their feelings into these, and that is so important, and I would never disrespect a girl's feelings because he's great.
Yeah, yeah, just
because that so is extra. Who he is.
So, one of the girls, however, wants to kind of pick a fight with Nokoru and challenges him, basically, to find this thing that she has hidden somewhere on campus, but he can't use any of his resources, he can't use any of his buddies, he can't use money, obviously, Nothing. So he...
Oh, and if he can't find it, he must, by a certain date, he must resign.
Yes. So it's...
And, like, she's been bitchy.
Yeah.
Like, very bitchy, and the other girls... Like, bitchy to the other girls, who are all fawning all over him all the time.
Mm-hmm. And to him.
Yeah. And I can totally understand, in every way, being a little grossed out by some of this, because it's very brown nosy, and there's a little bit of, like, oh, I understand your enthusiasm for this hot boy, but for fuck's sake,
yeah,
could we, like... contain it and yeah, not actually
like
just...
I remember in third grade all the other girls, like, well, most in my little circle of friends were all in love with this one boy who was fine, but like, oh my god, it was so annoying. And I remember just being like, I don't get this, I don't understand, what is so special about this boy, stop.
And being, and I also, like, have sympathy for being in that place where you're like, oh no, the like, communal fervor feeds on itself, right?
Oh yeah,
it's
totally.
Almost more of a social thing you're doing with other girls rather than having anything to do with that
boy. I mean, I've definitely been on the other
side. I'm really gay, and so for me, I'm just like, ooh, the most important part of this is definitely the girls.
God, well, I definitely, when I was slightly older, was definitely on the other side, where I was, you know, one of many who had a crush on the same guy, so no shame to my, you know, third grade friends.
Yeah, yeah, everyone can be in all of these locations, but it's one of those things where, like, if you are on the outside of this, it can be incredibly annoying. So I had some sympathy for her, but she definitely came across as being unhinged in how angry she was at him over nothing in particular. Because, like, she's not angry at him for, I don't know... frivolously using wealth that should be redistributed to the working class. Like, she's not there. She has nothing here that's not personal. Anyway, yeah.
So as Nokonu goes through the trials and tribulations of having to do this on his own, and he's very noble about it, but
yeah, he's very
you get to see him
it.
Like digging in the dirt and looking soaking wet in the rain and being very tragic,
and his buddies can't help him.
Yeah, they're all very distraught at the fact that this seems like an unfair task, and he might have to resign, and he's too noble to refuse such a ridiculous request. And of course it comes out that the girl has had a crush on him and didn't really know how to deal with that, and so instead, and especially since there were so many people who also were fawning over him,
yeah,
and so this kind of came out instead as resentment and, like, attacking him and stuff. And
I think it's maybe, like, the best piece of social realism in this.
Yeah.
Like, this is not, you do not go to this for insight into how relationships work, but that one piece, I'm like, ooh, that feels very like an experience people have actually had.
Yeah, especially people in, like, elementary school, yeah. Middle school. Like, I feel like that's a thing that when you're young and you're navigating, like, why am I so fixated on this person? You sometimes don't understand how to correctly, like, channel or interpret those emotions.
Yeah.
But Nokonu, being super magic genius baby, totally figures out where she buried this thing in the gardens she always goes to.
He figures this out using, like, he has two superpowers, right? He has his wealth, and then he has this power of, like, being so attentive to all the girls on the campus. And we kind of mentioned this. We don't mean he's in love with all the girls on the campus and he's, like, super horny about it.
Mm-mm.
We mean he just seems to think that the most important thing is the, like, minute day-to-day basic happiness of all of the girls, and so he, like he's an elemental of caring about girls' feelings.
Yeah.
Okay? He's the avatar of making sure you had a good day today and asking how you are. It's very cute, and ridiculous. So he memorized her schedule, so he knew all the places that she usually would hang out in, so he was actually, like, systematically looking through all of the places that he would expect her to have hidden it. And he did find it in the last place. It's always in the last place you look, Lucy.
Well, I mean, that's how it works.
Anyway, I just need to say to our audience that Lucy's notes here, right, he totally accomplishes this because he is God. All right, so a part of me really wants to launch into a big discussion of Zaibatsu, the big industrialist families that are what Nokonu is supposed to be a part of, what the Monoyama family are supposed to be a part of, and, like, going on a whole big thing about that. But I think we're going to save it for next time, because got to have something to talk about for
and
the next volumes.
And we'll have more kind of, I'm sure it will come up a bit more in the next two volumes, and that way we'll have kind of more of a complete idea of how this series handles it, at least
yes,
the manga.
Because, oh, not just Stargaze, but I'm pretty sure that I would imagine Suo gets a little bit more time than zero time in the next few volumes. And his family has an interesting relationship with the Imonoyamas, if I remember correctly.
I feel like they do, but yeah. I don't remember either, because, like, as we keep alluding to, this totally reminds me of Odon High School Host Club, and there have definitely been things I have transposed, and it was definitely a little influenced by this, so.
Yeah, like, speaking of Odon High School Host Club, one thing that we did want to talk about a little bit is, like, where would this come from? Like, what is this connected to? And we're like, yeah, a lot of where it comes from is their own, like, doujin AU crossover space, right? Like, that's why it is this. But, like, hey, why a school story? Why a school, why a rich kid school that has all these kind of continental European British boarding school hints? And while they don't talk a lot about why you would choose those things, because on some level, well, isn't it obvious? School stories. Like, like, it's obvious we wanted to do this. There's a little bit of, like, why they look this particular way that I think we could very briefly discuss. Because, like, in the US, I'm not sure that most of anybody who's remotely around the 20-year age range of who I would expect to be listening to this podcast had a ton of experience with, like, British boarding school novels other than Harry Potter.
Yeah, I think the closest we get in, like, American literature is you get a lot of the kind of coming-of-age novels that, that frequently are about, like, school-aged boys, but it's usually not as much rich boarding schools, or at least boarding schools. I'm thinking of kind of like a separate piece.
Yeah, well, for us, we only get the, like, social realism kind of pieces. But there's an entire genre of, like, kind of schlocky kid literature in England and throughout Europe that are, like, just school stories, but the schools are these sort of posh boarding schools, and it's just like, here are stories about how the main character becomes the prefect, and how the main character jumps the horse real good, and how the main character saved the Christmas pudding, like, that kind of stuff, which my beloved Diana Wynne Jones makes fun of a couple times in some of her books, and not even in a mean way, because, like, this was the stuff she grew up with also, but, like, very instructive novels that are just supposed to, like, help the kid have something to relate to about school and get them prepared for what it's going to be like to be a good little student citizen. And then, of course, you have, like, the more salacious, somewhere between social realism and just drama stuff that might come out of other parts of Europe. And some of those that would maybe have homoerotic elements were really influential on the Year 24 mangaka group, who we sometimes call the 49ers. But, like, Hagiomoto and Takamiya Keiko and all of these people who, like, had a lot to do with changing what not only shoujo manga looked like in the 70s, but manga in general. They were super, super influential, and they were very influenced by a lot of European lit and British version. Like, they were influenced by some of that stuff, and they took it in all these directions that were very, very high drama, but very European inspired, because that was so exotic and fun and interesting, because it wasn't just, oh, the kids I know at school. This was extremely beautiful blonde curls children that are so magical and exotic to me. And I can definitely see the fantasy in that. So, like, I am not going to say that Heart of Thomas has anything to do with Clan Camp's detectives, because, like, they never, like, there is no real through line there other than there is a bit of a genre of stuff about adorable schoolboys having drama. Like, this is a thing. This is sort of, like, a genre thing that I think in the US no one would ever imagine that would be aimed at anyone older than the characters, but in Japan there is such an understanding that there is a little bit of, like, a safe fantasy in being excited about stuff happening to boys that are younger than you, so that there's no threat of, like, you're not really dealing with so much of, like, the gender relations of pubescent teens, like, kind of, like, leaving it in this zone of, like, safer childlike nonsense.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, these characters are so wish-fulfilling, and not necessarily in a, like, universal wish-fulfilling, and not necessarily in, like, a grossly sexual way, but, like, you can definitely feel the sense of, like, ooh, each of these boys is, like, the most amazing sixth grader that any girl could ever hope to meet.
Yeah.
But they're so non-threatening.
Yeah, and well, the thing that it kind of reminds me almost of in sort of more American literature is like the Hardy Boys and kind of like adventure stories. Yes. But again, it doesn't have that audience jump where it was the thing you'd aim at, you know, boys primarily, also young girls, but not like teenagers.
Yeah.
And this is definitely like in the magazine it was in, and in the way that they're writing it, where like they're including their fans are also like teenagers and college students. Like they have many female fans of varying ages.
It's very self-aware. Like this book is very self-aware that they're like, oh yeah, kind of admitting that, as with in modern publishing, the understanding that a lot of the audience for YA novels are college and 30-year-olds, like, that's an interesting thing. To like, ooh, there's something kind of safe about aging down that way. And again, like, it's not, like, creepy, but there's definitely a bit of like, ooh, this is very much the, like, a sort of fantasy of what perfect boys would be like.
Yeah.
And they would be non-threatening and super amazing and super rich and really skilled and talented, but not necessarily, like, again, non-threatening, not a threat to you in any way, because they're not horny at all.
Yeah, they're not hitting on you, they're not using, like, any of their wealth and power in a seductive way, like, aside from maybe being your best buddy or something, like...
Yeah. All of the romantic kind of imagery in it is very chivalrous. So we can't stop thinking about Odon with this. We will definitely bring it up a few more times, and we'll explain for anybody who does not automatically know what we're talking about. We will do a better explanation later. Yeah. But Odon High School Host Club and things like Utena, which are also about a very powerful student council, and oh god, we were talking about how some of the characters in Utena are like a year younger or a year older than these boys.
Like barely not much different. Like, yeah.
There are characters who are the same age between those two things. And this is like, Utena is like as dark as this is fluffy. but has that very continental flavor to it. This very like Western European, foofy, Rococo, like all of that kind of imagery and all of that kind of just like exoticism is there. And I was like, ooh, I think it's worth noting that there's a reason all that's connected, and it's mostly just that this was some of this sort of aspirational, fantastical, fun, but safe literature that girls would have had access to and been reading. And then, so you combine that with all of the really great detective stories that were in Japan, which they listed some of the things that were really influential on them, Sherlock Holmes is one of them, because those were very translated.
Yeah, they loved Watson more, which made me really happy, because I also like Watson. I mean, how can you not like Watson?
Yeah, I love Watson. But also Kogoro Akechi and Kosuke Kindaichi, Kindaichi Case Files, and like, oh, they loved all those mysteries. So I assumed, probably like as long as I've known about any of these things, that this thing was also like influenced by Detective Conan, because yes, we're just like, oh, Detective Conan, that's just been around forever. It's never not been around. It's one of the biggest franchises in manga. It's gotta be a big important part of it. And of course we looked it up so that we could give you guys good information, and it started in 1994, 2 years after this, and I'm not gonna say that Detective Conan is influenced by Clam Campus Detectives, because actually I'm really not gonna say that. It is definitely not in any way, but I was like, oh, I was going to be so excited to say, like, it's part of the tradition of kid detectives in Japan. I'm like, no. No, it has nothing to do with that.
Yeah. My mind is still blown by this. Like, if you'd asked me when Detective Conan was from, I definitely would have said, like, the 70s and 80s. Maybe even, like, the 60s. Like,
but also, the art does not look like 60s, 70s, or 80s art. Definitely 90s art.
It's true, but I just assumed I'd only seen, like, a 90s adaptation of it.
No, I just, like, there's so... It's just that it's been so continuous. But, like, it just has not... It has been consistently published since 1994. And there's a lot of comics that have been consistently published for a lot longer than that. Like, that is not unusual. It's just that this, for some reason, my brain really did assume that this thing was, like, their version of Detective Conan. And no, it is super not.
Yeah, like, they're doing many things, but that is not actually one of them.
Yeah.
All right, so I believe you wanted to round up with a discussion of kind of the, like, transition from fan fiction to their more professional stuff?
Yeah, or just sort of talking about, like, how this is... We've alluded to this before, but collaborative writing among groups of friends, like, to finding a place where you're going to put that, like, where you're going to put all your characters if you're all writing together. I definitely had a very X-Men-inspired school story that... an elementary school that I would make all my friends join with me. Mm-hmm. Like, up through middle school, I would have this, and then into high school, I think I sort of stopped in high school, but, like, that was a huge part of my childhood writing life. And there's something so amazing to me about seeing, like, I think that as a kid, my brother and I were talking about this when I saw him recently, and we were talking about, like, ooh, I think that I assumed, because of Clamp Campus Detectives, that this was a really universal writing experience, mm-hmm. that everybody makes up a school to write about their characters with their friends in. And I was like, oh, maybe it's not completely universal, but I assumed it was because these people had one. And it's interesting how, like, one data point, two data points, really, because me and then this one, like, turned into an entire worldview that actually made me embarrassed, because I was like, oh, if everybody does this, it must not be that important that I did it. But I'm like, but now I'm an adult, I'm like, oh, it's so darling that I did that. That was so important. It was so a big part of my friendships at the time.
See, that's so cool. Like, I did not have that experience. Like, I feel like I didn't really have fully unique characters until, like, middle or high school, when I definitely did have, like, you know, fully unique stories and stuff. But up until then, it was always kind of just, like, very, you know, Mary Sue-esque, and not necessarily in a bad way Mary Sue, but just, like, you know, the daughter of Simba or something, you know, like, with stories I would tell with my friends and stuff, but it wasn't, like, that removed, and I didn't ever have, like, a communal place that they would all hang out. But I do remember in, like, high school and stuff, we would definitely, like, draw each other's characters, and I don't know if it ever literally happened, but I can definitely see us, like, if we were making a comic, like, including each other's characters as, like, you know, background characters, just kind of for the fun of it, and as a fun little nod to each other and stuff, and, like, that is super relatable to me.
Yeah, it's part of what makes reading Clamp School Detectives right now so charming for me, because at some point they go to, what is it, the tea club? They're in, or, like, a garden terrace where there's, and we see a bunch of background characters all having tea at different tables, and it's the Duke Leon boys,
yeah,
and it's Eddie and our evil space prince,
yeah,
and are not at all evil, are totally not evil space prince,
yeah,
and, like, the girlfriend characters for Akira and Suo,
mm-hmm.
and some of the teachers who we know are like, oh no, this teacher is basically AU Taishokuten. Like,
yeah,
there's, like, characters like that just in the background. You're like, God, that must, I feel like for me that'd be really fulfilling to get to just sneak in characters. I kind of do that. I will sometimes sneak in characters from their projects and backgrounds in, like, professional comics that I do. I don't always, because sometimes I'm so in the zone of, like, that world and these characters that it doesn't even occur to me I have other characters when I'm drawing it. But sometimes I'm just like, what if Clash is a goblin and he's hanging out in this meeting with all the other cute goblins in my cute all ages kid story?
Which I mean, if you have to have background characters, like, you don't necessarily need to spend all that creative energy making new ones when you could just cast the ones you already have. Like,
see, but I love Oda Sensei so much, and One Piece always has such amazing background characters that are all, like, the each one of them, you're like, I don't know what that lion faced guy with the frog shirt is, but he's great. So I really admire the people who put that work into it. But I think it's also kind of, like, there's a nice way to create fan engagement,
mm-hmm.
where that's one thing I would say about, like, part of why this particular era of their work is really enduring. Like, think about how fascinated we were as high schoolers with these stories that we would not have been super interested in because they're a little, I mean, like, I don't just mean fluffy as in the stakes aren't high. I mean, the logic trains are a little derailed. They're not
plot lines are not great.
Like, yeah, they're not intricate.
Mm-hmm.
It's not super challenging for a high schooler. But just the idea that these characters were all interrelated was so interesting to us that it made us want to read them. It made us want to read everything. Of course we would buy Duke Leon, even if we weren't super into Sentai-looking stuff.
Yeah.
Like, of course we would buy it. Of course we'd buy 20 Masks, even though it was looked very, very, very childish, because we had to know what happened to the characters that we knew from this other thing. Like, that's really compelling, but it's also a thing that is so easy to do in amateur fiction, where you can cross over anything with anything, because you don't have to ask any publishers or editors or authors for any kind of permission. You can just do whatever you want.
Yeah.
Like, the great freedom of fan fiction is that you don't have to get permission, you just do it. The great, amazing, you know, like, that's really, really hard to do in any kind of published work, although it is doable, but sometimes there are very steep licensing fees.
Yes.
As I'm sure everybody working on all the crossover comics at IDW can complain about. I imagine the contracts hell is just in full force.
I'm sure. I mean, and even within Marvel, where it's all owned by the same people, like, there's gotta be just, like, such a headache of trying to keep track of everything. Like,
yeah, because they do pay attention to, like, characterizations and what's adding new things to canon. Like, there's no... It is all owned by Marvel, so they don't ever have to ask anybody on the outside for permissions, but they still have to try to keep some sort of internal consistency.
Yeah.
And they don't keep complete and total internal consistency, but they do have... There's some amount of keeping track of that they do. Yeah, I just, like, I really appreciate how this is something that can also be kind of difficult for getting into something. You're like, oh, if it's all interrelated, it makes it really hard to know where to start.
Mm-hmm.
But there's just something very compelling about reading this, and it reminds me of so much amateur fiction, but I think it would be a really big disservice to both amateur fiction writers and the truth about how there's no huge difference between amateur and professionals.
Right? Yes.
I mean, like, there are differences between the version you wrote for yourself and the version you cleaned up for publication so that other people could understand it. Like, there, there are some differences. There really, really are. But a lot of those are... They're not even superficial. They're just, like, they're small and they have to do with the process that you're going through.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than, well, if you just want to write about perfect people being adorable, there's just no room for that in mainstream fiction. Of course there's room for that. You just need to do something so excellently that other things not being super high stakes doesn't impact the interest that someone could have in that.
Yeah, and I really like these early ones, especially for just, like, there's just the fondness you can tell they have for these characters that they've been playing around with for so long, and with, you know, varying ideas of what those characters are going to end up being. Like, I think they mentioned Nokoldu is one of their oldest characters, and it's just so fun to... I mean, later stuff is obviously very beloved to them and to us, but it doesn't quite have the same feel of, like, the characters that they may have been thinking of since they were around that age, or, you know.
Yeah,
it's just, there's something really, really special about these early things.
Yeah, and relatable, but also something that, like, is easy for someone to talk down about, because it's so easy to act like there's something wrong with having cared about a character on that level, or it coming from your unprofessional days. Like, that we sometimes use language surrounding that to put people's work down. And the thing is, like, even I will sometimes say, oh, this thing is kind of fanfiction-y to me. And what I really mean is unedited and very self-indulgent without necessarily earning that with all the writing that you do in order to, like, when you're writing fanfiction, you don't need to establish all the rules. They're already there. And sometimes when I read something where I'm like, ooh, I feel like somebody thinks they've already established rules that haven't been established, like, that is a specific feeling that is not my favorite, and it's not great that I associate that with fanfiction, because not all fanfiction reads like that.
Yeah, I was gonna say, and then you read a fanfiction that's, like, better than most of the novels you've read recently, and you're like, well, damn!
Yeah, and just a reminder, like, yeah, this really has more to do with, like, some people's writing is just going to be amazing no matter what they do, because they're paying attention to plot details and world building and characters on such a wonderful level, and some people will glaze over some of those things, and it just makes the writing, like, less deep. Not necessarily not enjoyable and not necessarily unpublishable, but it just doesn't hit you in those ways. And that isn't really about fan fiction versus professional fiction, but there are through lines there of, like, oh, you read so much more amateur... Fan fiction is amateur fiction, and you read so much more stuff that is not amazingly well done. So you associate it with that.
Yeah.
But every professional writer has stuff that never gets published, and some of that writing, because it isn't as polished, reads probably an awful lot like somebody else's fanfic.
And because, some of it literally is fanfic.
Yes, definitely a lot of people go from fan fiction to published writing. A lot of people, and for some people, there's a lot of shame associated with that, and you don't ever want anyone to know. There is some controversy about the way that we treat somebody when we think that they're a professional versus the way we treat somebody when we think we're one of us.
Yeah.
And, like, and the accessibility that you think you, like, exists there between author and audience. Like, there's a lot of interesting things that I think we'll continue to talk about through this entire podcast, because it will come up in different degrees. But, like, it is interesting to think about a little bit of, like, how Clamp are regarded with regards to this, how they really did come from this world, and how we think of that as being so much more common, or some of us think of that as being more common with Japanese stuff, because the doujin markets are huge. It's such a big deal. But, of course, like, comics are really laborious, and they require a skill set that is not just, like, they require both the writing skill set and then a whole other skill set.
Yeah.
And writing for comics is a skill set that is not the same as writing prose.
Yeah.
So there's a whole level of just, like, it impresses people in a slightly different way, I think.
Yeah. I think we're rounding it out for today, but we're obviously not done with Clamp School Detectives. We're going
to
have
two more volumes to talk about. Yeah. And we're going to do the two volumes in one.
Yeah, I don't foresee there being any need to split those two up. I think they'll be fine. And then after that,
we are going to have an anime marathon like our high school days for all of the Clamp Campus Detectives anime with some friends.
We'll take pictures.
Yeah, it'll be cute. And there's a chance that we'll have a couple people that we know record their own things for that episode. Like, we might actually have some guests on that episode, which will be cute. We'll see if we can. We'll see if our, I don't know if we're sophisticated enough to do that, but we're going to give it a shot. And then after that, what are we... we'll be done with Clamp School Detectives after that.
I have our list. Okay. So after Clamp School Detectives in November, probably late, like the second episode in November, I'm guessing is how it will even out. It may be early December. We'll do The Legend of Sheng Hong, and which is their kind of retelling of a Korean legend, I believe. And then in December, we're going to do Shirohime Shiol, which is, I believe, the retelling of a Japanese legend. So those will kind of piggyback well, and then going to the new year, we will be able to start X, which, if you'll remember, we kind of shifted around all these 93 publication stories so that we could do X after doing more of the short ones, just kind of to give ourselves more of a break before launching into another dark, long thing.
Yes, and I still have a little bit of regrets about, like, oh my goodness, should we do X and Rare Earth at the same time? Because it feels weird to spend a year on X and then zoom back to 1993 or 1994 to talk about Rare Earth.
Yeah.
But you know what? We will hear your feedback on that, and we will figure that format out as we go.
Yeah, we'll figure it out. I still feel like it would be weird to chop X up with other discussions in between.
God, it really would.
Because it's such a continuous story, but we'll deal with that when we come to... Maybe a year into doing X, we'll decide, ugh, we need a break. So we'll see.
Anyway, if you want to follow us on this journey...
Yeah, you can follow us on Twitter at ClampcastPod, and on Facebook at Clampcast in Wonderland, and we also have a very not actively used Facebook group that's there. We are happy to use it, but it's currently just kind of hanging out. And of course, you can always go to our website, ClampcastInWonderland.com.
Thank you for coming with us on our journey through Clamp's Wonderland.
Until next time, remember that everything will be all right.
And try not to lose an eye.